This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's been just over 6 months of war in Gaza after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th of last year. Last week, following Israeli military attacks that killed humanitarian aid workers from World Central Kitchen, President Biden had a phone call with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. For the first time since October, President Biden apparently showed a willingness to condition continued support for Israel on how Netanyahu and the country's military act. That includes an effort to minimize killing Palestinian civilians and to allow more aid to safely reach them. After the call, Israel did announce some additional aid routes. We're going to talk about how the U.S. position toward Israel has evolved since October, how America's influence is being felt by the prime minister there, and how it could all affect the future of the conflict. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions, what thoughts do you have about U.S. foreign policy? When it comes to Israel, what do you want to see from the Biden administration here? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Guy Ziff is an associate professor in the School of International Services Department of Foreign Policy and Global Security at American University, where he's associate director of the Meltzer Schwartzberg Center for Israel Studies. His books include Readings in U.S. Foreign Policy and his latest, Netanyahu versus the Generals, The Battle for Israel's Future. Guy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
I want to start off with a listen to U.S. National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby speaking last Thursday at a White House briefing after that call I mentioned between Biden and Netanyahu.
On that phone call, the president emphasized that the strikes on humanitarian workers and the overall humanitarian situation in Gaza are unacceptable. He made clear the need for Israel to announce and to implement a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers. He made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps. He underscored that an immediate ceasefire is essential to stabilize and improve the humanitarian situation and to protect innocent civilians. And he urged the prime minister to empower his negotiators to conclude a deal without delay to bring the hostages home.
A lot there. Guy, what do you make of at least what the White House is saying about this phone call and whether it's a change in the U.S. attitude toward Israel?
I don't see this so much as a change of U.S. attitude and certainly not President Biden's attitude. But I think that President Biden has grown increasingly frustrated with Benjamin Netanyahu, the longest serving Israeli prime minister. And clearly increasing the amount of humanitarian aid and expediting the delivery of this aid is a top priority for the administration. There are so many challenges when it comes to aid delivery. It has to be delivered through the various Israeli security checkpoints for inspection. There are all sorts of bottlenecks with the distribution of this aid once it's in the Gaza Strip. There are efforts to prevent Hamas from seizing some of this aid, which it's done on numerous occasions in the past. And of course, the roads in Gaza are in awful condition as a result of this war. And these are the challenges with which the U.S. Must contend when it's pushing Israel to increase the amount and the expediting delivery of this aid.
The U.S., as you mentioned, hasn't really changed position all that much, mostly supportive of Israel. Military aid still goes to Israel. There have been some calls in the U.S. and elsewhere to say, hey, let's condition some of that aid on concrete improvements in humanitarian measures. Are we at that point yet? Is that something you see as being likely?
I see this as a growing trend among progressives within the Democratic Party who are frustrated with President Biden's overall support for Israel and for clearly stating that he was on Israel's side during this war, even though, as I mentioned, he is growing frustrated with Prime Minister Netanyahu. I don't see this happening in the immediate future under President Biden. There may be some steps that he will take if Netanyahu defies him, for example, if he decides to go ahead and invade Rafah in the southern part of Gaza, despite Biden's clearly stated opposition to an Israeli ground invasion there. So it's possible. It's possible that he might delay aid. It's possible that he might even go further and prevent certain offensive weapons from being delivered to Israel in the future. This is something that Democrats, or some of them at least, want to see happen. But I think it's enough to threaten to do so, and it's enough to kind of have this dialogue, some of which has spilled into the open with Israelis, and I'm talking about tough love here, that may be sufficient in getting Netanyahu to do what the administration feels needs to be done. So, for example, this week, we have already seen the highest number of aid trucks entering Gaza since the start of the war. There were 419 trucks on Monday, 322 trucks on Sunday. This is far, far greater number than anything we've seen up to this point. And you can say that that's a direct result of the pressure that the Biden administration has put on Israel. Israel has also agreed to open another border crossing into Gaza from the north to allow more aid to enter through that area. Israel has agreed to more maritime aid deliveries through its port in Ashdod, and also has agreed to expand aid through Jordan. So we're seeing progress here on the humanitarian front for sure.
Talking to Guy Ziv from American University, author of the recent book Netanyahu versus the Generals, The Battle for Israel's Future, looking at Israel, Gaza, and American foreign policy as it relates to the conflict there. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Guy, I want to turn from U.S. policy toward Israel to Israeli internal politics. Now, you were just putting the finishing touches on this book when the October 7th attack happened. You were able to get a little bit in the afterword about that. But you saw concerns about Israeli security based on the relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and security officials, military officials in Israel. What were some of the concerns you were seeing before October of last year?
Well, what motivated me to write this book was what I saw as a fascinating paradox. Netanyahu, who has throughout his entire career cultivated this image as Mr. Security, and was seen by a large percentage of Israelis as the kind of the one person in Israel who they can trust to secure the country. And on the other hand, there has been unprecedented tensions between Netanyahu and the security establishment, which did not begin with October 7th. In fact, I trace it to the very first days of his premiership, first term as prime minister in 1996. So to me, this was kind of a very interesting, very fascinating puzzle and paradox that I wanted to explore. And I submitted my final proofs on October 6th.
Wow.
And then after October 7th, I had to, of course, ask my publisher, who readily agreed to enable me to write that afterward.
We're seeing now protests within Israel, in part, many of the protesters putting blame on Netanyahu for security lapses leading to the attack, also demands to bring hostages home sooner. As you look at what's happening in Israel literally this week, what do you make of these protests and Netanyahu's position now?
I think October 7th and everything we've seen since October 7th have really shattered this myth that Netanyahu is actually Mr. Security. I mean, this is October 7th was the single greatest terrorist incident in Israel and in the history of the country, and the single greatest anti-Semitic event since the Holocaust. So this all happens under Netanyahu's watch. And I think that this finally kind of shattered that myth. And even many of his own voters have turned against him. And poll after poll shows very consistently that the majority of Israelis want early elections and they want to replace him. If there were elections held today, there's no way he'd be able to form a coalition government. What's also driving some of the animus towards him, both on the part of the security establishment figures, but also in the general public, is this notion that Netanyahu is putting his own personal and political interests ahead of national security interests, that by prolonging the war and by minimizing opportunities for a hostage deal, he is essentially enabling himself to stay in power so long as this war continues.
And that fits the theme of much of your book. That perception was there before October, that Netanyahu was interested in his own politics, his own personal gain versus security. This that accusation now isn't surprising to you, I'm guessing.
Not at all. I think that, and that's really the difference here. So the security establishment has felt this way for quite some time. Of course, active officers and generals and security personnel are not allowed to talk politics, but once they retire from politics, they're certainly open to say anything and everything on their minds. And the overwhelming majority of retired heads of the Mossad, the Shin Bet, former generals, former IDF chiefs of staff, have all, pretty much the vast majority of them, have come out against Netanyahu politically and personally.
It's Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hi. Well, I appreciate the question presented in respect to Biden and our approach to foreign policy. I wonder what your thoughts are on the Arab nations' response to this, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Qatar, Turkey, and the like, seem to have taken a very, they seem to have fallen back, at least the governments have, as far as how they perceive this. Do you feel that perhaps they're willing to see groups like Hamas and Hezbollah get their nose bloodied a bit? Where do you see their role in this? In this conflict?
Interesting question, Chris. Guy?
Good question. And I think the caller, you know, just hit the nose on its head. Basically, the idea here, hit the nail on its head, excuse me. The idea here is that there is a clear preference among many of these leaders who have made all sorts of diplomatic overtures towards Israel in recent years to deal a fatal blow to Hamas. Which they see as threatening to the stability of the region. Groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad and in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon. But they have to also consider and weigh the notion that the public opinion is not with them when it comes to Israel. That most Arabs, most whether it's Saudis or Egyptians or Jordanians, are not in favor of normalization with Israel, even though Egypt and Israel, for example, have had a peace treaty since the late 70s. But this is something that the Arab leaders have to really kind of walk that fine line. We have not seen them abrogate the Abraham Accords or any of the other treaties or agreements. We have seen a few of them recall ambassadors, but I think that's done more for public display as opposed to any sort of meaningful change. So privately, I think that they are on Israel's side, you could say. Publicly, they have to be a lot more careful about how they weigh their words.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about the ongoing war in Gaza. Some added pressure President Biden is putting on Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to address dire humanitarian concerns while pursuing its goal of eliminating Hamas. Guy Ziv stays with us, associate professor and foreign policy expert at American University. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see all of this resolved? Do you have hopes that something can come out of this, a lasting peace? If so, what would it take to get there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Guy Ziv, associate professor in the School of International Services, Department of Foreign Policy and Global Security at American University, talking about the ongoing war in Gaza, efforts to reach a ceasefire deal, new pressure from President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts. Let's go. Oh, we had a caller who just dropped. Bob in Menominee says Israel should have used more special forces instead of this wider scale attack. Worries about the impact on civilians. Was there, Guy, if assuming Israel had a goal of hampering or eliminating Hamas after that October 7th attack, was there a way to do that more of a special forces, I guess, surgical attack, as I think Bob was hoping?
I think some of those kind of smart weapons were not in Israel's hands. Also, Israel has learned a lot in the last half a year about strategy and tactics and Hamas's own plans, much of which was discovered during the initial operations. Definitely a greater attempt now with more insight, and one can add more pressure for Israel to make these. This is a different phase of the war. We're not seeing the same number of troops in Gaza. We're not seeing the same number of forces there, and we're also seeing much more targeted operations. So, for example, just today, there were Israel assassinated three of the Hamas chief's sons. So we're seeing much more targeted operations that are more surgical and precise in nature, that can avoid the kind of major civilian loss, civilian casualties that we saw in the early phase of the war.
Let's bring on another caller. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. I guess my ears really pricked up when the professor mentioned that this was the largest anti-Semitic attack on Jewish people since the Holocaust. I think that anti-Semitism has been being used as kind of a tool to criticize people who are just basically saying we want our land. Palestinian people have been kicked out of where they lived, and the reason that they are in some sort of struggle isn't because they hate Jewish people, it's because they don't live in their houses anymore. And I think the professor's using that kind of slyly to paint people as racist, as a lot of people do these days.
Chris, thanks for the call. Guy, what do you think?
Well, I would certainly make a distinction between criticism of Israel, which is 100% legitimate, and describing objectively what happened on October 7th. And on October 7th, we saw mass violence against Israeli civilians. Not only Israeli civilians, but these are people who were living quietly and peacefully in the communities in the southern part of Israel that border the Gaza Strip. Many of them were actually human rights activists opposed to the Israeli occupation. There were a lot of peace activists among those who were murdered and taken hostage. Some of them prominent activists, including those who spent a good chunk of their free time bringing sick Gazans into Israel so they could go to Israeli hospitals, volunteering their time on all sorts of peace related and humanitarian missions. These are the people who were killed, raped, and massacred. And so this is a very objective description of what happened on October 7th. The numbers alone, even without the descriptive part, attest to the largest single anti-Semitic incident since the Holocaust. We haven't seen anything else like it. And by the way, the UN report that was released just last month confirms an aspect of October 7th that had been widely dismissed or even denied in some sectors. And I'm referring here to Hamas fighters raping women and even corpses during the October 7th massacre and beyond. And we're not talking about a couple of isolated cases here, but rather Hamas's systematic weaponization of sexual violence.
Thanks again for the call, Chris. Guy, I want to take our last few minutes before October 7th. We had, I think it's fair to say, a pretty unsustainable status quo between Israel and Gaza and the West Bank, for that matter. And now, after October 7th, after the 6 months of conflict, do you see a road to something better than we had before, some more stable and hopefully peaceful resolution?
It's very, very, very difficult to express any sort of optimism at a time when people are suffering, when there are so many casualties, so many deaths, so many destroyed communities in Gaza and in parts of Israel. What I will say is that some of the tragedies in the past have paved the way for new ideas and even positive diplomatic developments. So, for example, if you look at the Yom Kippur War, the 1973 surprise attack war that occurred almost 50 days to the day of the October 7th Gaza Hamas massacre, we see that 4 years after the Yom Kippur War, Anwar Sadat, the Egyptian president who had launched that war, goes to Israel and addresses the Israeli people in the Knesset and calls for peace and followed through on that with the first Arab-Israeli peace treaty. We also saw that in the wake of the first Palestinian Intifada, we saw the Oslo Accords that gave at least temporary hope to Israelis and Palestinians for a better tomorrow. When Israel and the PLO formalized these agreements on the front lawn of the White House, that was when Bill Clinton was president, first term. And so it's definitely possible that something positive will eventually emerge. What we need is we need to lower the temperature, and we need to try to fight populist nationalists, those who are seeking to gain advantage by polarization, the politics of polarization. And what we really need are also leaders who can make some bold, even if they're unpopular, but bold steps for peace. President Biden, for example, has made it very clear that he is a supporter, not only a supporter of a two-state solution, as he's always been, but he is his administration's vision for the future is a two-state solution. We're not hearing this from either Hamas or from the Israeli leadership right now. But if we do have new leadership there, if we do see new leadership there, I think there's definitely some room for optimism, because at the end of the day, the Israelis aren't going anywhere. The Palestinians aren't going anywhere. They're going to have to figure out a way to live together.
Thanks to our guest, Guy Zib from American University. His latest book is called Netanyahu versus the Generals, The Battle for Israel's Future.